This is All of It. I'm Kushan Avidar, in for Allison Stewart. Today, we've been bringing you conversations with filmmakers, actors, and fashion icons about their work to improve their communities and educate the masses. The NAACP Image Awards are this Saturday. And next, we hear about author and poet Kwame Alexander's multifaceted memoir. Rather than a linear story, Alexander uses things like poetry, intimate letters to family members, and recipes like his mom's famous brown paper bag fried chicken. He does it all to invite us into his personal history. The book is called Why Fathers Cry at Night, a memoir in love poems, letters, recipes, and remembrances. It was nominated for Outstanding Literary Work of Poetry. Let's listen to Allison's conversation with Kwame.
So what did the outline of this memoir look like? The very, very first stages.
There was no outline. This book started as a collection of love poems.
Mm-hmm.
I was writing love poems that I hoped would impact readers and they would enjoy them, laugh, think about their love. But as I started writing them, I realized I was telling some sort of story.
Mm-hmm.
And my editor said, Kwame, you might want to give some context to some of these poems by including some prose pieces. That led to including some conversations and some letters and recipes. And it sort of morphed into what it is now, this memoir, this hybrid memoir. But there was no outline. I was just sharing my thoughts on romantic love and familial love and self-love.
What you described sounds like a collage.
Exactly.
Like the layers started coming in, and then this would dovetailing with this and intersecting with that.
I love the art metaphor, because I was talking to an interviewer, I feel like, I forget who it was, but she said, Kwame, do you think it was fair for you to write this book and talk about some of your family members? And I said, this book was a self-portrait. This was me talking about me. If I were trying, and there are other people in the background of my painting. But if I were to try to do a self-portrait of them, that wouldn't have been fair.
It's
definitely, you know, my portrait.
Why Fathers Cry at Night. Would you read that section of the book and then we'll talk about the title?
I have two daughters, and my oldest daughter, when she was 15, she came home one day and she said, Dad, I want to go out on a date. And I was like, no, you cannot date. Maybe when you're 30. And so my wife said, Kwame, My wife said, Kwame, you're going to have to deal with this. Like, do the thing you do to get over this, to remember. And I wrote a poem to be able to understand what it was like, what my kid was going through. 10 reasons why fathers cry at night. One, because 15-year-olds don't like park swings or long walks anymore unless you're in the mall. Two, because holding her hand is forbidden and kisses are lethal. Three, because school was fine, her day was fine, and yes, she's fine, so why is she weeping? Four, because you want to help, but you can't read minds. Five, because she's in love and that's cute until you find his note asking her to prove it. Six, because she didn't prove it. Seven, because next week she's in love again and this time it's real. She says her heart is heavy. Eight, because she yearns to take long walks in the park with him. Nine, because you remember the myriad woes and wonders of spring desire. And 10, because with trepidation and thrill, you watch your teenage daughter who suddenly wants to swing all by herself.
That's Kwame Alexander from his book, Why Fathers Cry at Night, a memoir in love poems, letters, recipes, and remembrances. That poem is also about loss for you.
Yeah, it's the...
It's about love and loss at the same time.
Yeah, it is. I mean, this is, you know, my two daughters, I would walk them to school, hold their hands, swing them around. You know, all the things that parents do. And there just came a point where all that stopped. And I remember I just moved back from London, where I was living for 3 years. And we moved there when my daughter, my youngest daughter, was in the sixth grade. And so every day I would walk her to school. And we held hands. And by the end of the school year, there was no more holding hands. And by the beginning of seventh grade, it was, you can't walk on the same side of the street as me. And by like a middle of seventh grade, it was like, I can do this by myself. And I'm like, I know you can, but I want this.
Yeah.
And so you forget about you know, you got to live in the moment as a parent because those moments are so fleeting. They go by so fast. So, yeah, mm-hmm. it's about a little bit of loss and trying to figure out how to still, you know, how to just be cool with it, I guess.
Let's say your daughters pick up this book in 10 years.
Right.
What do you hope they understand about dad?
Yeah. You're asking all the hard questions. I love it. It's like, you know, I'm thinking, why y'all all of my business? And then I'm like, but I wrote a memoir. So I've been married twice. Mm-hmm. I been divorced and now separated. And one of the things I thought about, Allison, is when my kids look back on my life, I want them to extend a little bit of grace to me mm-hmm. in a way that I didn't do to my parents, mm-hmm. and particularly my father, in which I'm now starting to understand to do that. And so one of the things I want them to know is how I loved and how I love their mothers. Mm-hmm. I feel like that's important.
Very much so.
That the narrative isn't the divorce. Mm-hmm. It isn't the things that went wrong. It's the things that went right and how we made you. I wrote a piece called How We Made You mm-hmm. for my daughter. In the future, when you're newly married and the two of you are half hanging off your bed, fingers playing in each other's locks, your legs braided, loud garbage trucks beeping outdoors, no whining children yet to cook for, and you're talking about leaving your job, or whose family to visit for Christmas, or how lucky you are to be loved like this, or whatever it is you talk about after making love in the early morning, I want you to know that before our uncoupling, your mother and I used to work the door at a jazz club in Washington, D.C., and every Thursday night, we'd stand at the front door collecting covers, greeting friends and regulars, feeding each other jerk wings, kissing the hot sauce from our lips, joking and laughing about this and that, holding each other when it got chilly. And later, when we get back to our one-room apartment on the other side of the bridge, we'd spread the money out on the bed, count our haul, smile if we could pay the rent, worry if we couldn't, and then we'd make our own music. And without fail, the woman next door would bang on the walls and tell us to turn it down, but we wouldn't because we couldn't, because we knew how lucky we were to be loved like that. I just want them to know, mm-hmm. you know, that I loved, how I loved. That's what I want them to know.
When did you first start writing poetry?
I was 12, I think. And I had read a lot of poetry and been read a lot of poetry, too, by my mom. Mm-hmm. As a kid, she read to us Lucille Clifton and Nikki Giovanni, spent mm-hmm. a soft black song, and Dr. Seuss. But when I was 12, it was Mother's Day, and I didn't have any money to buy her a gift. So I wrote my mother a poem, because that was the one thing I felt like I knew how to communicate. I thought mm-hmm. I was a pretty good poet. I was horrible. The poem was like, "Dear Mommy, I hate Mother's Day because in my heart, every day is Mother's Day, and I love you, dear Mommy." And like, she cried.
Aww.
And I was like, I'm a pretty good poet. That was the first poem, but, you know, and that was the beginning of sort of my writerly mm-hmm. journey. But it didn't start, you know, as a idea for a vocation or mm-hmm. professional until college.
Is poetry, in hearing you read those two pieces specifically, I picked one and you picked one. Is it therapeutic for you, writing poetry? I feel like both those poems worked out some stuff.
Absolutely. You know, what did Langston Hughes say? Poetry is the human heart distilled, you know? And so it takes these sort of big, weighty concerns, themes, things that we're contemplating, pondering, dealing with, and it allows us to be able to sort of drill down into a moment that impacts our heart, mm-hmm. that makes us feel something. Like, the fastest way to change the way you think or act is by going to, you know, dealing with how you feel about something. Mm-hmm. That's like a basic building block. And so, you know, writing this book, I was able to sort of feel and acknowledge and begin to understand a lot of things in my life that were not serving me, perhaps were serving me. And of course, we know, when it comes to therapy, mm-hmm. you sort of get the understanding of what to do, but then you got to go and do the work, Allison. Mm-hmm. Like, the book is just the first step. Writing the poem is just the first step. It's acknowledging. But now you got to do the work, and that's kind of hard.
you tell on yourself in the book about your professor, Nikki Giovanni, and how she, when she was your professor, gave you C's, and you did not like that, and you decided you did not like her. And you wrote a response play, shall we say, about a certain kind of professor who chain smoked. But then you all later came to be friends. I'm jumping ahead a little bit.
Sure.
Do you remember what made you so mad at that moment? Was it ego? Were you concerned that you weren't going to get to do this thing you wanted to do? What was the source of your being so mad at Professor Giovanni?
I thought I was the best poet alive. In my mind, by the time I was 12, I had read Sonia Sanchez, Nikki Giovanni, Langston Hughes, County Cullen. I memorized mm-hmm. Heritage, What is Africa to Me, Copper Sun or Scarlet Sea. Like, I knew poetry. Mm-hmm. My father and mother were extremely bookish. So I grew up in this house where language and conversation and reading and writing were reward and punishment. Mm-hmm. Right? And so I knew words. And so when Nikki Giovanni came to Virginia Tech in 1987... I was familiar with her because I had read all her stuff as a kid. But more importantly, I felt like I was going to be the quintessential student.
Yeah.
I signed up for advanced poetry. Had never taken a poetry class, signed up for advanced poetry, right? And I take her class. And
that's funny.
I start getting these C's, like you said. And so, yeah, it was my ego. I was hurt, and I didn't understand it, and I thought it was wrong, mm-hmm. and I thought it was personal. That's that immaturity. I was 18. I went to college at 16. I was 18 years old. It was that immaturity. So that's where it stemmed from. And you know, come to find out, all these years later, me thinking it was I didn't like her and she didn't like me. It was just me. It was one sided. Mm-hmm. And she says to this day, Kwame, I didn't give you a C. She's in town, by the way. She'll be there tomorrow night. She said, Kwame, I didn't give you a C. But if I did, you deserved it. And you see where it got you. Mm-hmm. You can't argue with that.
My guest is Kwame Alexander. The new member is called Why Fathers Cry at Night, a memoir in love poems, letters, recipes, and remembrances. Let's talk recipes. When did the recipes come in?
So, you know, like I said, I moved to London in 2019. We were there for 3 years. And one of the things I decided to do when we got to London is my mom passed away in 2017, and I had felt like I wasn't very close to her. You know how they say when your loved one passes away, you'll hear from them or they'll send you signs, you know, that kind of thing, especially in our community, mm-hmm. that spirituality is so important. And I grew up in a very spiritual and religious house in a family, in a community. And so when my mother passed in 2017, I didn't have any connection. I was like, mm-hmm. I would pray or meditate or ask, where is she? Can I talk to you? Mm-hmm. I didn't even know how to do it. I didn't know how to do it. And so when I moved to London, I said, well, okay, why don't you start cooking? Why don't you learn how to cook as a way to begin to cook some of the recipes that she made for you as a way to get closer to mm-hmm. her. And so that's where the cooking thing came in. And I taught myself how to cook. And one of the first dishes I cooked was her fried chicken. Because my kid loves fried chicken. Mm-hmm. So that was going to be my thing. I'm going to make this fried chicken for her. And the first couple times, it was horrible. It was horrible, yeah. Allison.
Those moms have magic. My mom used to make like just a mound. She like, and she, it's funny, she had like the most perfect manicured nails. She was the most, she was a school teacher. She was, everything was in line. Even when she fried chicken, it was delicate, but it was like a mound of fried chicken.
Right.
And it went away quickly as soon as me and my friends got home.
I mean, the first couple times I made it, you know, I wanted to make sure it was cooked so it was too burnt or it wasn't cooked enough, which is problematic, or, you know, it wasn't seasoned, it was just bland. I remember, you know, in London, there's no such thing as buttermilk. And so I remember trying to figure out how am I going to mm-hmm. make buttermilk fried chicken, and I called my friend Jacqueline Woodson. And Jackie said, Kwame, you should get some milk, cup of milk, put a teaspoon of lemon in it, squeeze a lemon, teaspoon of lemon, and put it in the fridge. Let it set for 15 minutes. Buttermilk. I was like, oh, snap.
She's like, yeah.
Yeah. And so... So my point is by sort of iteration number 9 or 10, I had figured out how to make fried chicken. I had deconstructed mm-hmm. and re-engineered this process because there were no written down recipes. And my sisters, maybe they said, add some paprika, or somebody said, use this kind of flour. So I sort of figured it out. And here's what happened. My kid loved it. And we would smile sitting across from each other. And I realized, Allison, that I was able to get closer to my mom because I began to mirror the relationship I had with my mom with my daughter.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm writing the book at the same time. And so, of course, it just made sense to tell that story and include the recipe. And if I'm going to include one recipe, then I'm going to include another.
There's a bunch of good ones. Bunch of good ones.
Thank you.
There's a poem in the memoir called An American Love Poem, and there's a part that references book banning. The last stanza reads, I want them to know that banning a book is like banning a hug, and that is a dismal storm no child should be left behind in. I'm going to give you the opportunity to sound off on banned books at the moment.
Yeah, I appreciate that. My friends and I, we talk about that a lot because many of them have been... Their books have been, quote, banned. Jerry Craft, Jason Reynolds,
mm-hmm.
of course, Judy Blume. And here is my take on it. And I'll share this quick story. One of my books, The Undefeated, that Kadir Nelson illustrated, had been banned in a place called Bryan, Texas. I flew down to Bryan, Texas, because I had seen a tweet that one of the teachers had posted how much she loved my books and she was sad that the books were being banned. I flew down to Bryan, Texas. I called the librarian. I said, hey, I'd like to come to your school. She said, great. I want to surprise the teacher. Mm-hmm. I said, great. Have him in the library. I get to the school. 100 students are there. The teacher's there. She's all excited when I walk in. Oh my gosh, you're Kwame Alexander. Yes. Assistant superintendents are there. 3 TV stations are there. Like the place is packed.
Wow.
So I go in to read from the book that everybody knows, The Crossover. The kids are loving it. I'm reading it. And then when I finish, I pull out The Undefeated. I'm in the library. Yeah. You can't kick me out. I read The Undefeated. This is for the unforgettable, the swift and sweet ones who hurdle history and open a world of possible, the ones who survived America by any means necessary, and the ones who didn't. And the kids are like on the edge of their seat. And the administrators are on the edge of their seat. And they see that this book is about hope and upliftment and triumph over tragedy. And Maya Angelou's quote, though we may face defeat, we must never be defeated. And at the end, it's all love. I don't spend a whole lot of time worrying about the folks who have forgotten what a book means, mm-hmm. who have forgotten that their mother's reading to them and how much it meant to them, who have forgotten that. I don't spend a lot of time thinking about them. I pray for them. I hope for them. I spend more time figuring out how I'm going to get the books in the kids' hands.
And you show up.
And I show up.
The book is called Why Fathers Cry at Night, a memoir in love poems, letters, recipes, and remembrances. That was Allison's conversation with author and poet Kwame Alexander. Jazz harp player Brandy Younger's album, Brand New Life, celebrates one of the instrument's greatest players, Dorothy Ashby. It won Outstanding Jazz Album. That's coming up next.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.